The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week, we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Oscar Edmondson, and on the podcast this week, Matthew Paris asks what's left to say about the Tories. Laurie Graham discusses her struggle to see a GP. Rachel Johnson says that women don't want women-only clubs. Laura Gascoigne tells us the truth about Caravaggio's last painting. And Angus Colwell reads his notes on wild garlic. Up first, Matthew Paris.
Spare a thought for us political commentators. We stare into the void between now and a presumed decisive Labour victory in a presumed autumn general election, haunted by the need to say something significant on a weekly basis at least. Yet there seems so little left to say. Until recently, we could perhaps speculate that the election might be next month, but it's surely too late now even for that surprise. So, autumn, we say. No surprise there. We think we know the winner, too. Labour, easily. I struggle with betting terminology, but a glance at online odds suggests to me that if you bet £5, there'll be an election in October to December 2024, and win, you'll get £6 back. And if you bet successfully on the next Prime Minister, you'll get £6 for every £5 you put on Keir Starmer. That's hardly even gambling. Nobody thinks these outcomes are interesting because they can predict them with such assurance. But assuming that we commentators are tasked with writing 1,000 or so words every week until, say, Thursday the 21st of November 2024, we have another 32,000 words to write. This is the length of a small book. Whatever are we going to write about? We'll do our best to fill the void. There are various ruses. A favourite is what one might call the light novelist's approach. Glancing at his menu as the Prime Minister sat down for the Confederation of British Industries annual lunch last Monday, a smoked salmon mousse with cucumber and dill to start, then chicken breast with a tarragon cream sauce and herb-roasted potatoes, followed by miniature chocolate eclairs, Rishi Sunak could have been forgiven for feeling glum. Even the soaring Victorian architecture of the Grand Hall at Old Billingsgate Market, the CBI's venue for this prestigious event, will have been unlikely to lift his spirits. The following day's cabinet meeting will bring the usual tension between the standard bearers of the right, urging a tougher stance on the threat posed to his Rwanda policy by the European Court of Human Rights, and the habitual caution of his cabinet moderates. A teetotaler, the Prime Minister was denied refuge even in the New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc or an indifferent Côte d'Iron. And he knew the right would be on the warpath, as we report on page XXX today. Letters, it was being rumoured, were about to go in. Well, that takes us about 170 words down the track, without having said anything at all. And we still have some 830 to go, having reminded readers of what they already know about the PM's travails and given them as much information as they could possibly want about CBI lunches. We have to move on. How? Well, since whatever meets the eye about political prospects this year has already met the eye of our typically quite knowledgeable reader, we must next embrace what must be a founding premise of political punditry: that there is more, much more, to this than meets the eye. And that presents us with a problem, because there almost certainly isn't. Readers don't need to be told that the Tories are in an unholy mess, fighting like rats in a sack, or that nobody likes them, most people aren't going to vote for them, and there's nothing that even the Archangel Gabriel, still less Sunak, could do to rescue them. Nor does the reader need reminding that the Tories are already trying to blame each other for the mess, and that after the next election, what's left of the party will descend into a bloody factional fight for whatever each faction takes to be the soul of conservatism. There, that took only about 90 words, and any more would be superfluous. For the moment, the Tories and their self-inflicted wounds really don't matter. And this, I'm afraid, our readers have understood ahead of us pundits. We keep writing about the Conservative Party as if it mattered. We really must kick the habit. We could write instead, I suppose, about reform and what Nigel Farage is likely to do. We can do this in 40 words. Mr. Farage will play peekaboo for a bit longer and finally emerge in some leading role in reform, which will inflict serious damage on the Tories, but beyond that never amount to much because they don't really have any policies. And that leaves the Labour Party. As I've remarked, we commentators are bound to say there's more to Keir Starmer, Rachel Reeves and co. than meets the eye, because what meets the eye is insufficient fuel for us, so very dreary and underwhelming. There don't appear to be any policies worthy of the name, while the leading personalities sound like no fun at all. The best we can do for scandal is to allege that Angela Rayner may have saved a few thousand pounds by deeming one house rather than another a principal home. And really, who cares? So, if there's more to Labour than meets the eye, what is it? Ah, we say, don't you see, that's exactly the point. That's what's so crafty. They're keeping their powder dry. Then we tap our noses and explain that what's so devilishly clever here is that Labour realise that if they tell the voters their policies, the Tories will steal them, cost them, discredit them, whatever. So, ho-ho, Labour are keeping it all up their sleeve. Cunning, eh? Well, maybe. My lifelong experience of people, politicians and parties of whom or of which it's said that there's more than meets the eye is that there very rarely is. I doubt Keir Starmer has the least idea what he'll do in Downing Street. He just wants to be Prime Minister. Well, if her recent Mace lecture is any guide, Rachel Reeves is determined only not to do anything silly. There we are, 40 more words. Whatever shall I write next?
That was Matthew Paris. Next, Laurie Graham.
Nye Bevan did not make old bones, and perhaps it's just as well. According to a recent British Social Attitudes survey, 52% of those polled are dissatisfied with the NHS, in particular with the difficulties in getting a GP appointment, with long A&E trolley waits, and with huge delays for hospital appointments. All this in spite of ever more money being chucked into its maw. If invited, I could immediately save the NHS a packet by dialing down the thermostat that has turned hospitals into Hotel Tropicana for bacteria, and by asking, wherever possible, patients' relatives to provide food, thereby reducing the amount of unappetizing slop that goes straight from plate to bin while the sick go hungry. But that is not my theme today. My theme is something rather clever invented by NHS thinkers to distract us from our dissatisfaction. Window dressing. I, like everyone else who cannot afford private healthcare, must join the 8 a.m. scrum to speak to a receptionist and request an appointment with my GP. Fat chance. But that's not to say I'm ignored or overlooked. I hear from the practice all the time. Invitations to this, online surveys about that. Would I like to complete a questionnaire about my drinking habits? No, thank you. Unless, might this be a devious way of getting called in for a little chat? How many units a week would that take? Into my inbox, the messages ping, how to calculate my BMI, advice on seasonal health, an invitation to a coffee morning if I'm feeling lonely. Nothing wrong with coffee mornings for the lonely. I volunteer at one myself. It's a simple idea, like being a good neighbour with the possible bonus of cake. I'd praise any GP practice for organising one, if they were already getting their day job right. If asking to see a doctor, preferably one who's met you before, were not such a Sisyphean task. Where once, in waiting rooms, there would have been dog-eared copies of National Geographic, my practice now has TV screens, the more efficiently to numb our brains while we wait. You can watch a short video on hand washing or an animation about physiotherapy services. It's a cheap sideshow that might just make you a less impatient patient, or customer, as we're now called. Very canny. These shiny novelties are a combination of bread and circuses aimed at keeping the discontented quiet, and a magician's distraction technique. The elusive doctors are concealed behind a Bell and Whistles practice website. It is a thing of wonder, packed with advice. You can spend hours looking at it, and I have. Suffering from a cough or cold? Go to Boots. And, handy hint, if you have toothache, consider seeing a dentist. They might as well tell us to go straight to a hardware store and buy pliers. I was puzzled to read that consultations with the diabetes nurse and something called the well-being clinic are currently only available remotely. Or was it remotely available? Relieved, though, to see that the nail-cutting service is still conducted face-to-face, or rather face-to-foot. There's also a social prescribing clinic where you can explore what matters most to you. Being allowed to see a doctor without being made to feel like a millstone around the NHS's neck would certainly be on my wish list. A shiny website with a Meet the Team page may lure you into a detour, looking at photos of doctors you'll never actually meet. But eventually pain or anxiety will likely drag you back to the symptoms pages, which include a quick guide to red flags and 111 callback options. Good luck with that. Remember when your GP would see you in his surgery or even visit you at home? A physician who knew you and your family, wrote notes with a pen, and would never fob you off with a well-being practitioner. It was a very fine system, Nye, that in the 1980s we became customers, so now we're targeted with glittery, tinsely kidology to stop us noticing that the doctor won't see us any day soon. And this just in. I'm invited to tell us your story, your personal experience of healthcare over the past 3 years, which they may publish on the website or not. I imagine the editors are looking for uplifting and grateful stories, not embittered rants.
That was Laurie Graham. Next, Rachel Johnson.
In my experience, men offer this infuriating comeback when challenged about the continuing exclusion of women from clubs such as the Garrick. For now, at least, the Garrick's voting on the 7th of May on the admission of women as members. But why don't you set up your own women-only clubs, they sulk, and leave us alone? My interlocutors are often members of not one, but multiple men-only clubs. My husband, father and brothers, for example, frequent a combination of White's, the Beefsteak, Pratt's, men only until last year, and the Garrick. Two of my siblings, à l'époque, graced the Bullingdon at Oxford. As I recall, I had my own wedding reception at the Savile. So I've never condemned their patronage of these establishments and enjoy my occasional visits, even though they can make me feel like a toddler on a school trip. It will pass without incident, only so long as I don't sit at the wrong table, use the wrong staircase, or look too tarty or tatty to pass muster at the bar, at which I can't place an order. In fact, I almost respect men I've spoken to for articulating in this hostile environment any objections to the imminent prospect of the monstrous regiment of women storming one of the last citadels of the chateau-bottled patriarchy, Clubland. Nobody gives up power lightly. I can see why penis owners of a certain vintage cherish their comfortable place in town where they can read the Daily Telegraph in a wing-backed leather armchair, entertain a friend over Dover sole, or gulp a glass of Sancerre before the theatre. The fact that these clubs are full of powerful and important men, apparently, is not my main objection to them either. The membership lists may well be a roll call of the establishment. Don't care. No, my objection is to the supposed alternative. Women-only clubs. They'll never catch on. Lynn Franks set up three Beehive women-only business networking spaces in Covent Garden, Manchester and Bristol in 2010, but they folded. La Franks has a new project called Seed Hub in Wincanton, which the legendary PR says will be a nurturing place for women to come to be recharged and inspired, and nothing like the classic club where men fall asleep with cigars in their mouths. The women-only club chief in Bloomsbury, membership costing up to £7,900 per annum, closed last month. After taking a critical look at where we need to strategically focus, we've made the extremely difficult decision to exit the UK market, said one of the American co-founders. Another American women-only club, The Wing in Fitzrovia, folded after less than a year in 2020. The Albright Club tagline, "Invest in Ambition," is still active and promotes itself as a space where women can thrive professionally. Funny that. Women-only clubs are all marketed as networking hubs, while men-only clubs are effortlessly social and superior. They're not glorified WeWork spaces. No part of the clubhouse may be used for business purposes, which includes discussing business matters, as it says on the Garrick's website. And that surely tells us all we need to know. Men want to carry on with their cosy clubland in gentlemen's London, as they always have, while we busy bees can have our networking hubs. No thanks. I don't think I'd be keen, says Julie Birchall. You're not meant to say it these days, but I generally prefer the company of men. This isn't internalising misogyny. Don't blackball me. If I'm out, like Julie, I want men about me too. After surviving lockdown, when men from the government told the women of Britain to stay at home, we don't want to pay an annual sub to socialise with our own sex. We want to slip the surly bonds of domesticity as often as we can. In Andrew O'Hagan's ace new novel, Caledonian Road, a female KC is talking to her brother. Half the people in London at those old boys' clubs you like going to, the ones that hate women, had better watch out, she warns him, because the party is over for them. Well, it does look like the Garrick, for one, will allow women, finally, to both beat them and join them. As the vote nears, we'll hear the argument repeated that if women can have female-only spaces like changing rooms and rape crisis centres, men should have their own men-only spaces too. Yet, women-only spaces are for their own protection rather than enjoyment. Men-only spaces are for the perpetuation of privilege and, of course, peace and quiet, which is why the Garrick's been around for 193 years and you have to wait 15 years to become a member, if you're lucky. Women want to be where men are, and men want to be where women aren't, says my husband, member of Pratt's and the Beefsteak, sounding pleased with himself. And you can quote me.
That was Rachel Johnson. Now, Laura Gascoigne.
For centuries, nobody knew who it was by, or even what it was of. The picture that had hung unnoticed in a succession of noble palazzi in the Italian province of Salerno, with its deep chiaroscuro and close-crop composition, looked like a Caravaggio. But after Caravaggio, almost every painting in Naples did. When it entered the collection of the Banca Commerciale Italiana in 1973, it was attributed to Matteo Preti, a Calabrian Caravaggista of the next generation who had caught the Tenebrist bug. but in 1980, a letter discovered in the Naples State Archive changed the picture. Written on May the 11th by Lanfranco Massa, Naples agent of the Genoese nobleman Marcantonio Doria, it explained a delay in the transportation of a painting of St. Ursula to Genoa. Massa had left it out in the sun to dry more quickly, and the varnish had gone soft, because, he said, Caravaggio puts it on very thick. He was going to talk to the artist about it. Why the hurry? Caravaggio was preparing to leave Naples, the city which had been his refuge on and off since his flight from Rome on a murder rap 4 years earlier. A rumble on a tennis court in May 1606 with local pimp Ranuccio Tommasoni, reportedly over a bet of a woman, had begun with tennis rackets and escalated to swords, and Tommasoni had been fatally wounded. His Roman patrons were prepared to forgive the artistic genius with the cervello stravolto, the deranged brain, a multitude of sins, but this time he had gone too far. He left Rome with a price on his head, a bando capitale entitling anyone in the Papal States to perform a citizen's execution and produce his head in evidence, and he fled south to the Spanish-ruled kingdom of Naples. Described by Cervantes as the richest and most depraved city in the whole world, Naples was then, as now, very different from Rome. It was three times bigger, with a population of 300,000 crowded into its warren of narrow streets, all of them full of people on foot, on horseback, in carriages, in the words of a contemporary guide to the city. Not much has changed. Replace the carriages with Fiats and the horses with Vespas, and he could have been describing Naples today. For an artist on the run, it was the perfect bolt hole, rich in wealthy patrons, and in the middle of a Baroque church-building boom that reached from the historic centre to the Rione della Sanità, where a new basilica to the Virgin had been designed by the Dominican architect Fra Nuvolo. In Rome, Caravaggio had struggled to win church commissions, but here they fell into his lap. Who better than the celebrity artist to paint the seven acts of mercy for the high altar of the Pio Monte della Misericordia, the new church built by a charitable confraternity of young do-gooders in the Via dei Tribunali? The dramatic nighttime composition Caravaggio produced, with all seven acts squeezed into a corner of a Neapolitan street with a cast of local characters, a virgin and angels fluttering like pigeons between the rooftops, announced his arrival. This astonishing work, which inspired the closing scene in John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, with its shocking image of a young woman breastfeeding a starving old man, is one of only three paintings by Caravaggio still in Neapolitan hands. The Flagellation of Christ, painted for San Domenico Maggiore, is now in the collection of Capodimonte Museum, currently on display in Naples Diocesan Museum. But the Martyrdom of St. Ursula, which normally hangs in the Banca Intesa San Paolo's Galleria d'Italia, its current owners, is coming to London's National Gallery for a free display, the last Caravaggio, joined by the gallery's own Salome Receives the Head of John the Baptist, and Massa's manuscript letter. Unlike the seven acts, St. Ursula was a private commission, chosen to mark the entry of Doria's stepdaughter into Naples convent and her taking the name Sister Ursula. According to medieval legend, Ursula was a Breton or British Christian princess who made it a precondition of her marriage to the Anglian Prince Etherius that he grant her 3 years' grace to make a pilgrimage to Rome with an escort of maidens in waiting, 11,000 of them by some inflated accounts. On their return back alone, the pilgrims had the misfortune to run across a horde of marauding Huns. Struck by Ursula's beauty, their leader offered to spare the women's lives if she married him. On her refusal, a massacre ensued. Earlier artists had used the story as an excuse for painting a bevy of virginal beauties under Ursula's protection, or a killing field littered with female corpses and severed heads. Caravaggio had nothing against painting severed heads, witnesses John the Baptist, Goliath and Holofernes, but crowd scenes were not his thing. An early adopter of the Robert Capa principle, if your pictures aren't good enough, you're not close enough, he posed his protagonist steps away from each other, so close that his Ursula can hardly have seen the arrow coming before closing her hands on its shaft as it penetrates her chest.
Her head is inclined at the angle of Leda's in Michelangelo's Leda and the Swan, and her expression is rapt. She has taken a mortal hit for her Christian God. All eyes are fixed on the couple, but they're not alone. Other figures lurk in the background shadow, barely visible through the murk. One thrusts a foreshortened hand between the archer and his target, too late to intervene, while a soldier lays a gauntleted hand on Ursula's arm, juxtaposing the flash of steel with flesh. Behind the soldier, the artist has painted his self-portrait, head tilted, as if craning for a better view. Seeing the painting in the Galleria d'Italia, surrounded by works by Caravaggio's followers, you can understand how it might have been mistaken for a Preti. It lacks the surface polish one expects from a Caravaggio, although that could be the fault of Massa's fast-drying method. But seeing it beside the National Gallery's Salome, also dating from the end of his second stay in Naples after short breaks in Malta and Sicily, the parallels are obvious. You come upon the scene midway and you're immersed in it, Martin Scorsese observed about the painter he credits with inspiring his shooting of Mean Streets. This is how violence looks up close, as Caravaggio knew. It's this, as much as the one-directional lighting, that makes his work feel cinematographic. Is the Martyrdom of St. Ursula the last Caravaggio? There are other contenders for that title, not least the Galleria Borghese's David with the head of Goliath, with its grisly self-portrait painted for Cardinal Scipione Borghese in the hopes that he would swing a papal pardon for his uncle Paul V and stop the artist's decapitation becoming a reality. St. Ursula is the last Caravaggio to be rediscovered, but there may be others out there. Salome was only identified in a Swiss private collection in 1959. When a painter has so many imitators, his work can easily get lost among them. Even while he was recovering from another rumble in a Naples tavern that left him almost unrecognisable, Caravaggio's last months in Naples were extremely productive. Three paintings of that period, A Resurrection, A St. John and A St. Francis for Santa Anna dei Lombardi, are unaccounted for. There's also the record of 100 ducat payment towards a circumcision altarpiece for Santa Maria della Sanità, due for completion in 1612. The version of the subject now in place is by one of Caravaggio's army of imitators, Giovanni Vincenzo Forlì, but X-radiography of the paint's surface has revealed a telltale grimace on the face of the girl with the basket of fruit, squeamishly witnessing the operation. Had he hung around long enough to finish it, this might have been the last Caravaggio. A banner outside the church today boasts "È meraviglioso essere napoletano." It's marvellous to be Neapolitan. Caravaggio didn't think so. In expectation of a papal pardon, he couldn't wait to get back to Rome. But trouble dogged his footsteps. When the felucca he boarded in July stopped off in the tiny port of Palo, he was arrested by the captain of the local fortress in what seems to have been a case of mistaken identity. With his scarred face, he must have looked like a villain. By the time he bought the captain off, the felucca had sailed with all his belongings and three paintings aboard, Salome possibly among them. In desperation, he tracked the boat through the midsummer heat 70 miles up the mosquito-ridden coast to Porto Ercole, where he succumbed to a fever, probably malaria, aged 38. And so, wrote his biographer Giovanni Baglione, without the aid of God or man, in a few days he died as miserably as he had lived, leaving behind a body of work that feels more alive than that of any other painter in history.
That was Laura Gascoigne. And finally, Angus Colwell.
For a certain type of barber-clad middle-aged man, the best time of year is late summer and the arrival of grouse season. But if you're in your 20s and living in Hackney, you're more likely to get excited for spring and the arrival of wild garlic. Foraging has become a fashionable activity for 20-somethings. Instagram has changed the game, says the nature writer and wild garlic picker Patrick Galbraith. People love the foraging aesthetic. Some fans generously compare notes online on the most fruitful spots. Others gatekeep. The Instagram page Real Housewives of Clapton, which satirises the lifestyles of young bourgeois East Londoners, has gained a following, making snide memes about hopeless amateurs foraging in Doc Martens. We're currently at the peak of wild garlic season. From the middle of February, woodlands across the UK break out in long green leaves. It is truly beautiful. The green is deep, like the feathers on a duck's neck. It's tempting to say that they're unmistakable, but no, there is an imposter. The poisonous lily of the valley. The trick to not poisoning your dinner party guests is to smell the leaves. Lily of the valley has no odour. Make sure you bring some scissors to slice through the leaves so the plant survives. Foraging veterans often complain that the novices are uprooting everything. The National Trust say that they have seen some examples of commercial and unsustainable foraging in recent years and told people to take only 1 in 20 plants. Picking wildflowers is legal for personal consumption, but not commercial gain. Yet Cornish locals say gangs are loading wild garlic into pickup trucks and selling it onto restaurants. One councillor said people should take down car number plates and contact the police. And a resident in Lostwethal saw people slashing away with 8-inch knives in bin bags. Last year, a national newspaper ran a piece about the unsustainability of the wild garlic craze, followed 2 days later by a recipe for wild garlic macaroni. So, perhaps the trend is just another case of arrogant city dwellers exoticising the countryside. But who cares? The plants can grow in Battersea Park, and the main outcome has been some respectable home cooking. In the past few years, I've been treated to delicious meals around people's flats, most memorably a friend's orzo with wild garlic pesto. Wild garlic is so effortlessly good on so much, says Jeremy Lee, chef proprietor of Quo Vadis. Coarsely chopped with walnuts for pesto, in soup, or risotto with nettles, ground with olive oil to make a pleasing unguent, in ricotta with anchovies, in polenta. Patrick Galbraith recalls shooting some rabbits with a friend, then making a wild garlic and rabbit pizza. Weston's Laundry, a restaurant in Highbury, has a dish of rabbit legs, asparagus, snails, mash and wild garlic. Perhaps wild garlic's appeal lies partly in its impermanence. Supermarkets stock most herbs and vegetables all year round, but wild garlic has remained seasonal. Its appointed hour is a delight at the time, and it never outstays its welcome, says Jeremy Lee. We bid a fond farewell and meet a year hence.
And that's it for this week, but if you enjoyed those pieces, why not pick up a copy of The Spectator magazine to read much more like them. I'm Oscar Edmondson, and I hope you join us again next week.